River high, river low, river fast, river slow. The dreams come soon. And the dreams soon go.
That's Les McCann on piano and also singing River High, River Low. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, April the 24th, and we pause to acknowledge and remember Michael Rupert, host of the Lifeboat Hour here at PRN-FM, a man with an extraordinary history and an even more extraordinary sense of duty and obligation to others. He took his own life on Sunday, April the 13th. He was 63 years old. And I thought we would start by having a listener who had written me about the impact of Michael's death on him. He is Ray Hopper. And Ray, what are your thoughts today?
Yes, Eutrice, I'm here. Hello.
Hello.
And I thank you for doing this tribute again. So in remembering Michael C. Rupert, I found myself thinking of the question, when does great insight cross over and become clairvoyance? And that question may not have an answer, but in Mike Rupert's case, I think he lived in both realms. He not only connected the dots, but he saw way beyond the dots into completely new territory. This was a man who deeply and viscerally looked into the human condition. And in so doing, he subjected himself to a lot of psychic pain. He walked his talk. He came from the heart, to use a First Nations expression. And as much as aspects of life angered him, he also was a man of great compassion. For me personally, Mike exposed me to the totality of peak oil, the hidden machinations of the security state, the ideas and activism of Cynthia McKinney, the late Matt Simmons, and Dr. Guy McPherson, to name just a few.
I'm listening.
Yes.
Okay. That's it?
That's it, unless you have a vein you'd like me to follow.
But, you know, you talked a lot about the impact, and this is interesting about broadcasting. You know, we're very seldom aware of the impact we're having on each other when we share information, and he clearly had great impact on people as he shared his information. And I want to just thank you so much for getting us started and for telling us what Michael Rupert meant to you. Thanks so much, Ray, for calling in today.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. Well, here's Michael Rupert explaining himself in his own words, which I think is one of the best ways to introduce oneself, a person of that caliber. There's so much to say. But these are the things that he felt important to say about himself.
I was born into an intelligence family in Washington, D.C. My mother was a cryptanalyst for the Army Security Agency during the Second World War. My dad was an Air Force aviator, a B-17 decorated veteran of World War II, later became a radar intercept officer during the Korean War. He went to work for Martin Marietta, and I discovered that my calling was to become a cop, a Los Angeles Police Department officer, which I did after graduating from UCLA. I had interned while I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I was assigned to patrol in South Central Los Angeles, the highest per capita crime rate in the city in the 70s. I became engaged to a career contract agent for the CIA, and it was then that the CIA tried to enlist me to become involved in protecting drug smuggling operations, bringing drugs into the country, and I refused. I blew the whistle. I was shot at, threatened. I was discredited, went through a very intense period. My fiancé left me, and the chief of police at the time, Daryl Gates in Los Angeles, refused to back me up. So I resigned from LAPD at the very end of 1978. And I spent about 18 years doing other things, and I slowly evolved into becoming a freelance writer. I was a gifted writer in the police department, and that's why I was so valued in detectives, because I could write the case summaries and investigative reports. But I evolved as a matter of self-preservation and trying to find out what had happened in my life, because I didn't know all the pieces then, into doing research and reading news stories and analyzing news stories and writing to members of Congress, meeting members of Congress. And what was really a futile 18-year quest to expose the fact that the CIA was involved in the drug trade. In 1996, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Gary Webb, from the San Jose Mercury News, uncovered documents, was given documents that directly linked the CIA in the Iran-Contra era, which was just after my time, to the smuggling of huge amounts of cocaine into the United States, which helped precipitate a cocaine epidemic in Los Angeles and which spread around the country, the Crips and the Bloods and all that bloodshed that arose. And those documents absolutely confirmed everything that I had been saying, and there was a national furor over that. Congresswoman Maxine Waters and major political figures jumped on that bandwagon. And, of course, I had predated Gary's work, and I became involved, and there was a town hall meeting at Locke High School in South Central Los Angeles. And Congresswoman Juanita Millender McDonald chaired that hearing. And I was called on, and the CIA Director John Deutsch was there with a big panel, including Congressman Julian Dixon, who later died very suddenly of mysterious circumstances, and Congresswoman Jane Harman, who is not one of my favorite people. But I confronted the CIA director, and I said, I am a former LAPD narcotics detective. I work South Central, and I can tell you the agency's been bringing drugs into this country for a long time. I was interviewed in depth by the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee. I was told I would be allowed to testify. I never was. I was asked to submit written testimony. But over a period of time, because the record was very clear, and I had an unblemished record as a police officer, I wasn't fired. I started being asked to do public appearances and some lectures. And then it was clear to me that there was a need for some accurate news about what was going on. And in March of 1998, I started a newsletter called From the Wilderness. I mailed out 68 copies to names that I had collected along the way, and it was an 8-page newsletter, and I said, if you like it, send me 25 bucks, and I'll do it again next month. That grew over the course of our eight-year history to having 20,000 subscribers, including 60 members of Congress, professors at universities around the world, major business figures, and we broke a number of major stories. Our publication was used in many congressional hearings. Our investigation was, and our reporting was respected on Capitol Hill. Dana Perino was returning my calls from the White House press office. My calls were returned from every department of government, CIA, FBI, because they knew I was a good journalist and the stories were useful. But the biggest story that we ever broke was the Pat Tillman cover-up in 2006, I was contacted by Mary Tillman, Pat Tillman's mother, Pat Tillman being the former Arizona Cardinals defensive back, who joined the Army Rangers, or the Army, and became a Ranger right after 9/11 and was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan. And that was covered up, and it was a massive cover-up. And out of sheer frustration, Miss Danny Tillman, that's what she goes by, contacted me. My military affairs editor, Stan Goff, is a retired master sergeant from U.S. Army Special Forces who had taught at West Point. And I visited Mary Tillman at her home in the Bay Area and copied 2,000 pages of Army records. I took them back to my offices in Oregon and flew Stan out, and together we decoded. Stan did most of the work, but we absolutely established that there was a detailed cover-up. We published a 7-part series. Stan wrote it. I published it, edited it, did the fact-checking to make sure, and ultimately, that resulted in the hearings run by Congressman Henry Waxman of the House Governmental Affairs Committee, which resulted in the disciplining of 9 officers, 3 of them generals, and almost all of us believe the sudden resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld when he was the next guy to be called. The cover-up went to the White House. During the course of that series, our offices were burglarized and all 7 of our computers were smashed. A massive campaign was waged to shut us down or to discredit us. I fled the country and went to Venezuela for 4 months because the only thing that could have prevented the story from being published was my death. And that essentially was the end of the newsletter. I came back from Venezuela in late 2006. Basically had some very severe challenges. I had lost everything. I was poisoned in Venezuela. I had a lot of recovery to do physically. Moved back to Los Angeles in 2008, back to my home, was kind of trying. I had had one book published, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, in 2004. Sold about 100,000 copies of that book. It's in the Harvard Business School Library. It's about that thick. And in that book and also in my newsletter, I had predicted the 2008 economic crash in stark detail, linking it to subprime mortgages, fraudulent bundled package of mortgage-backed securities. I named the banks and the investment houses that were involved, and many other factors that led to the financial collapse. So, and I had made over the years a great many predictions, not only about economic corruption. I had done exposés on Citigroup and AIG long before they became household names for their corruption. But I had also become, in late 2001, very aware of a thing called peak oil, which is probably now the universally accepted fact. It's been out in the mainstream media pretty much completely in 2010. But I saw clearly that there was a connection between the events following 9/11, the U.S. occupation of Iraq to seize its oil supplies, the second largest known reserves on the planet, peak oil, and the fact that the U.S. government was clearly aware for a long time that we were going to be facing a situation like we're facing now, both economically and from an energy standpoint. There's a 96% correlation between greenhouse gas emission and GDP growth. Ipso facto, if you want to have GDP growth after a collapse, you must burn oil to do it. There is nothing that will replace the edifice built by fossil fuels anywhere. So I was kind of trying to figure out what to do with my life in 2008, early part of 2008, but I was very much aware that that the economic collapse was imminent, and that peak oil was imminent. And I've made a great many friends over the years in Congress. On the right, I have the greatest respect and admiration for Congressman Ron Paul, who appeared in my video, Truth and Lies of 9/11, filmed in 2001. And on the left, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. And Cynthia was the Green Party nominee for president in 2008. The first thing I thought was, we need a platform on energy. We need a real one, a solid one. And that evolved into a presidential energy policy, which was the first title of the book now known as Confronting Collapse. By the time we're into September and October of 2008, we are well into the economic collapse, which began when oil prices peaked at $147 a barrel. I don't think anybody disputes that that was the trigger for the first stage of the collapse of human industrial civilization. And it was very clear to me then that we had passed, if you will, a watershed moment in human history then, that there was no coming back and that no amount of bailouts or cooked books or printed money was going to reverse the inevitable collapse of human industrial civilization and a die-off of what might be ultimately proved to be 3, 4, maybe 5 billion people. Because there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food consumed in the industrialized world, and the chart of human population growth has added, shows 5 billion people exist today only since oil was first used. We use oil for fertilizers, pesticides, we use natural gas, and oil is involved in flying grapes from Chile and moving food around the world in ridiculously unproductive ways. And commercial agriculture is totally dependent upon fossil fuels. In February of 2009, I was approached by director Chris Smith of Blue Mark Films, and that's how the movie came to be, and Chris did an absolutely brilliant job. The peak oil movement really originates from the work of former exploration geologist and physicist Marion King Hubbert, who was a giant in the oil industry, who did some math calculations about circa 1949, and he said very clearly that we're going to reach a peak of production and we're going to start running out of oil. All oil production, whether it's in one well or one field or a nation or the planet, always follows a bell curve up and down. And once you have reached peak, no matter how much technology or wishful thinking or money or anything else you throw at the problem, you will never be able to produce more oil than you did at peak. Now it's pretty clear. Professor Ken DeFaze of Princeton had calculated and predicted a peak in late 2005, and he was absolutely right. You usually only find out looking in the rearview mirror. But Marion King Hubbert in 1949, 1950 was saying, maybe a little bit later, that U.S. oil production would peak in 1970. And he was, in more ways than one, metaphorically burned at the stake for heresy, called a kook, a doomsday. But everybody shut up in 1970 when U.S. oil production did peak. And his numbers, of course, are ironclad, and they've been borne out. And he is really the father. He is the chief prophet, if you will, of the peak oil movement. A great many people have followed him. I was taught by the greats now, Colin Campbell, Shel Alaklet, Matthew Simmons, people who have been at this, Ken DeFaze, Professor Al Bartlett, who have been at this for a long time. And I, with my newsletter, I jumped right into it because there was a perfect correlation, or if you will, an obvious mesh of interest between peak oil and the U.S. government's conduct immediately after 9/11, when the first priority of the Bush administration was to invade and occupy Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. I, of course, was on it before the attacks of 9/11, and one of the most infamous crimes that I think in U.S. history was the National Energy Policy Development Group run by Vice President Cheney. I was screaming about it at the time, which used the many millions of dollars of taxpayers' money and then classified and refused to share with the taxpayers what their money had paid for. And these were many months of secret meetings with oil executives. We have been able to divine since that time that clearly what NEPDG was doing was finding out who had the oil, where it was, what they had to do to get it. It's very clear that long before the Bush administration, the U.S. government was aware of the imminence of peak oil. Well, let me backtrack. There's two very important historical events that occurred. In 1974, King Hubbert was called to testify before Congress, several days of testimony, and it was blistering testimony, not yelling and ranting. It was terrifying as to what the ramifications of peak oil would be. That's very significant because Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976, and he was the first president to really warn us about energy shortages, and we all saw what happened to him. People talk about the suppression of peak oil as something done by the oil companies. No, the oil companies aren't in charge. The oil companies are a part of an infinite growth economic paradigm based upon fiat currency, fractional reserve banking, compound interest, debt-based growth, which is by definition an unsustainable pyramid scheme. The oil companies are a part of an infinite growth economic paradigm based upon fiat currency, fractional reserve banking, compound interest, debt-based growth, which is by definition an unsustainable pyramid scheme, which demands something that is not possible in this universe, infinite growth. It's not possible. I published on my website, From the Wilderness site, it's still there as an archival site, fromthewilderness.com, declassified CIA documents from 1974 showing that the CIA was very aware of peak oil. And those records are still out there. So the issue is not the oil companies making profits. The issue is that there cannot be economic growth without energy. And this is probably the key point that I make in the movie Collapse and in the book Confronting Collapse, which originally had a subtitle of The Siamese Twins of Energy and Money. You can't separate them without killing both. Because there is no combination of energies anywhere, I repeat, that will replace what oil does or has done. Now, we have picked all the low-hanging fruit, obviously. We are now having a 70,000-barrel-a-day leak from the Deepwater Horizon well, which was a bridge too far, the ultimate reach off the tree limb to get that piece of fruit, and we've fallen off, and we don't have the technology. Man's greed for energy and consumption and infinite growth has led us to this point. I'll refer to two very important, one book and one study. The book was by Professor David Goodstein, Vice Chancellor of Caltech. He said something that's very clear to people in the energy industry. It takes 30 years to change an energy infrastructure and trillions of dollars of investment. Another study was completed in 2005 by Robert Hirsch of Science Applications International Corporation, a major government contractor, a think tank, among other things, very sophisticated company, and Hirsch concluded the same thing. He laid out analyses saying, what happens if we recognize peak oil and we start taking action 20 years before we get there, 10 years before we get there, and if we don't do anything until it arrives? And the upshot of it was we're mildly screwed, we're screwed, and we're totally screwed. And we are totally screwed because no action was taken to prepare for it in advance of peak oil. Because Wall Street demands infinite growth, and any acknowledgement of peak oil would have devastated share values on Wall Street. It would have brought an end to the consumer economy. And it would have threatened, and unfortunately in the United States today, almost all major media is owned by corporations which trade their shares on Wall Street. Period. So here we are now at collapse. It is here now, being accelerated by this absolute catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico. And we are looking at a die-off of many billions of people, the collapse of which is proceeding apace even as we speak. It's been proceeding since 2008 through Eastern Europe. It's now devastating Greece, which is not just an issue of energy, because money is useless without energy. One can't eat money. Money only is a symbol representing the ability to do work, which energy really is. So you can print all the money you want to. You can't eat it, nor can you put it in your gas tank. So we are now at a point where human civilization, human industrial civilization, supporting 7 billion people, is toast. Universally throughout the movement, I was hardly the first to think of this, and it's actually kind of obvious if you think about it, relocalization is the only way to survive the collapse of human industrial civilization. Here now, at this particular moment, in an idyllic place in Vermont with, you know, wonderful place, it doesn't look so difficult. But when you look at cities like New York, Las Vegas, Phoenix, with, you know, little or no fresh water, Los Angeles, where I'm from, clearly there are going to be major problems with dislocation. Not only unemployment, foreclosures, we all know what that looks like, but it's going to get worse as hunger really starts to set in and as we discover that the government can no longer bail anybody out. A great writer, Dmitry Orlov, he's Russian, and he survived the collapse of the Soviet Union. He and many others describe the stages of collapse. First is the financial collapse. Well, that's already well underway. Then comes commercial collapse. That's interruption with the flow of goods and services. That's underway right now. It's much further underway just anecdotally in Britain, where goods that they've had on the shelves in British supermarkets, and Britain is a basket case right now, are no longer available. Then comes political collapse, and we are on the cusp of political collapse right now. Just recently, the IMF issued a detailed report saying that another round of bailouts would trigger massive civil unrest worldwide. Well, Greece is in a state of full-scale revolution. A lot is not being covered in other countries, but just this morning I opened a daily digest of news stories that is research for me. I taught these people how to do it, showing that the Irish people yesterday stormed the Irish Parliament and almost took down the gates of the Irish Parliament House. This is what's going to be happening here in the United States. As first the federal government and state and local governments go bankrupt and are forced to curtail what most of us assume were God-given rights that come from someplace, the social contract is broken. The social contract will be raped, is what will happen. We will see in 2010 of a mathematical certainty tens of millions of people lose all of their unemployment benefits being exhausted and state governments and the federal government being unable to replenish that. All over the United States, it's not being widely broadcast, but for example, the state of Minnesota has introduced legislation to cut its state police force in half. Major police departments around the country are cutting back. Fire departments are being cut back. Street lights are being turned out. This is what collapse looks like. School districts cutting back to 4 days a week, and it's very unpublicized, but the hardest hit states, Ohio, Michigan, California, are quietly releasing convicted felons from prison because they can't afford to feed them anymore. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that with massive unemployment, no unemployment benefits, people being released and police departments being cut back, that's a recipe for civil disorder on the high scale. It's inevitable. It will be here in this country this year before 2010 is out. So these are very challenging times, but as a result of all these cutbacks that are happening all around us now, we see a recipe for civil unrest, and now we see the potential for displaced populations looking for places to go. There are people who want to go back to the bar who don't believe it, who call us doomers. There are people who are deer in the headlights, who are panicked, who cannot process a thought. But thank God there are many, many hundreds of thousands and millions of people, I would say, in the United States alone, who get it, who are actively building lifeboats now. And a lifeboat is something sustainable that's local, first and foremost, where your food is grown close to where you live. That's the foremost issue right now. You have to accept that not everybody's going to make it off the Titanic. It's easier for people who have been in combat, the military or police department, to accept the reality of casualties on a battlefield. They're inevitable. But the deal is to make lifeboats to save as many people as possible. And from my perspective, as an author, philosopher, lecturer, we are also in a battle to determine what will survive of mankind's history that will be carried over after the collapse, where we will have a very painful transition phase and era that will be bloody, messy, but eventually the dust will settle. The question is, what will survive? The choice being presented to mankind now is either evolve or perish, grow up or die. Change the way you view the world and your relationship to it, because I believe this planet is alive. And I believe that we have to establish a basic fundamental connection with all life on this planet to achieve something called balance or steady state, whatever you want to call it, sustainable, that doesn't pretend or aspire to overturn the physical laws of the universe or to make man a god, but to make man hopefully an intelligent creation living in harmony in God's universe.
That was an introduction, a self-introduction by Michael Ruppert. Talking about himself and what matters to him. Now, why I encountered Michael Ruppert was actually indirectly, and this goes back to the 1990s when African Americans in Los Angeles they were talking about something that seems so completely out of the world, just incomprehensible, that the communities were being flooded with drugs. And then we saw the epidemic of the crack cocaine addiction starting there and mushrooming outward. And the people were saying, the government is doing it. And of course, this was dismissed out of hand until Gary Webb, a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter with the San Jose Mercury News, started writing a series that no one disputes literally cost him his life. He was found dead. It was ruled a suicide. However, there were two shots to his head. So it was extraordinary that somebody would be able to kill themselves that way. But Gary's stories, in effect, were hinged on to Michael Rupert's initial investigations. And it is so odd that we find that common thread today. I just, you know, that's really why, that's how I met Michael Rupert. And I want to take you back there to how he explains this whole thing, how it happened, that the CIA, he said, was in fact bringing in tons of cocaine, having it sold on the streets and through a connection of a network of drug dealers. The money, the profits, went to buy guns for rebel groups in Honduras and other places that the CIA covertly was supporting. We may not get to the entire tape today, but I do want you to understand how this thing came about, this revelation, how it started. And Michael Rupert was at the beginning of that. And in the end, the stories by Gary Webb that fueled this whole discussion and the congressional investigation, and it was an extraordinary thing. But it was essentially validation of what the people were saying at ground level. So here is Michael Rupert once again discussing how he became aware as a narcotics detective in Los Angeles that the government was in the drug trafficking business.
Now, I was chosen to intern for Chief Ed Davis at LAPD, having been groomed and having already been spotted as, you know, part of the, you know, the establishment, the in crowd, the, you know, an up and comer. Craig was chosen to intern for Governor Ronald Reagan. Craig was George Bush's chief of staff during Iran-Contra. As I was chosen to intern for Chief Davis, I was exposed to people from Army Intelligence and an operation known as Garden Plot. I was told that I had a Q clearance when I was 20 years old, and I had to go home and ask my father what the hell a Q clearance was. I didn't know. In the Organized Crime Intelligence Division, I got exposed to one guy in particular by the name of John Xavier Vock, and I was told that he had, or he was, a CIA-connected guy in LAPD. Well, it gets to where I'm just about ready to graduate from UCLA in 1973. I'm, magna cum laude, and the world is my oyster. I had interned for LAPD for 3 years. My family buys me a plane ticket. I go back to Washington, D.C., and I go for an interview with a CIA in the old executive office building. And here's this guy behind this desk with this huge CIA emblem on the wall behind him. And he says, Mike, I've looked at all your stuff. You're just a wonderful kid. You got a great background. You're in great shape. What we'd like you to do is to graduate from UCLA, join the CIA as a case officer. And a case officer is the highest rank within the agency. You know, that's the highest level. There are levels above that. But, you know, that's the creme de la creme. And we want you to then, after you're a CIA case officer, go back and go through the Los Angeles Police Department Academy, and LAPD will be your cover. I sat through the interview, and I got a stack of papers about that thick for my clearances, and I said, thank you very much, and I came back to LA, and I threw them away, and I said, that's illegal. I don't want anything to do with that. I joined LAPD in 1973, was valedictorian of my academy class, went to work in an area called the Jungle, which is down near Crenshaw and Martin Luther King. Was having a great time. I was a good cop. I loved it. I never had so much fun in my life. I mean, it was what I wanted to do, and I thrived on it. I specialized in narcotics, and then I met and fell in love with a CIA agent. She came to my regular old cop bar, and we met and fell in love. This is what we call the unofficial recruitment. It was more fun than the one in the office, I'll tell you that. And she knew people in LAPD's intelligence divisions. I didn't even know who they were. She kept mentioning this general by the name of Lee Goforth, and I'm going, well, who the heck is he? Well, he's a general, and he deals with terrorists. And I'm going, wow, well, sounds great. Then she'd mention organized crime figures, Carlos Marcello, New Orleans, Hank Friedman, Dan Horowitz, and other names like that. And then she'd tell me things out of my confidential personnel package at LAPD. There are two packages, one in your division and then a master one at Parker Center. And then after a while, when we got engaged, she said, I work for the government. My people are very interested in having you go to work for me, or for us. Bada bing, bada boom. And then she started taking trips, and she'd come back from Hawaii, and she'd say, yeah, I was in this room, and there were 50 kilos of cocaine and close to 1,000 M16s. Now, me being a narc, by the way, LAPD, when I was in Watson, I confronted John Deutsch, said, he's never worked narcotics. Okay. United States Department of Justice Drug Enforcement Administration, Michael Craig Rupert, that's me. I didn't get it for writing parking tickets. I just wanted to do that in case LAPD was there. I said, look, if I'm ever in a room with 50 kilos of cocaine, somebody's going to jail. I mean, what's wrong with you people? I mean, here I had been on loan to Wilshire Narcotics a few times writing search warrants, happy to get an ounce, and she's talking about 50 keys, and I, you know, I'm, wow. And no, we never touch the drugs. What? No, we don't touch the drugs. We kind of follow the guns. Okay, I'm not going to get involved in anything that overlooks drugs. Well, she related the same stories as having occurred in Baja California, in Del Rio, Texas, in the Bahamas, in New Orleans. And I kept saying, well, it was long before MENA. This was in 1976. We hadn't even got to MENA yet. And I kept saying, I'm not going to, you know, and I thought it was some kind of test. You know, I thought they were testing my integrity. I'm not going to do anything that overlooks drugs. Forget it. I'm a cop. Anyway, after a while, it became clear that I was not going to roll over, and she disappeared very suddenly. Right after she disappeared, a bunch of Italian thugs walked into my mother's real estate office. And then I found myself on loan to Organized Crime Intelligence Division. And who do I wind up working with but a guy named Lee Goforth, who was a senior detective, Detective 3 in Organized Crime Intelligence, and a Brigadier General in the California National Guard. He was also LAPD's representative to LEIU, Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, which is very heavily influenced by the alphabet soup. His younger partner, Norm Bonneau, and who's in OCID, but John Xavier Bach. So now I'm having all kinds of weird things happen. Hang up phone calls, burglaries, I'm getting followed, I have to spy on my mother, you know. Gather intelligence. This is a little stressful. In 1977, I got burglarized. Now, she left saying that someone was trying to kill her, and that was the cover. Somebody stole one of my guns. Somebody stole a photograph of her. And somebody got an address that I had just gotten on her in New Orleans. So my captain, who was to this day one of the finest men I've ever known, a guy by the name of Jesse Brewer, who was the black police commissioner here in Los Angeles during the time of the riots, a wonderful human being, went to bat for me, says, look, OCID is lying. What do you want? Take a vacation. I went to New Orleans, and that was the biggest mistake of my life. I got to New Orleans, and she's got an apartment with a scrambler phone, and I didn't know what it was. It's just like this 8-pound telephone, you know, that looks like a normal phone, and then, but it has a little thing that you plug into a wall socket. You know, when you plug that in, and then, you know, I had to describe it later, years later, to an Air Force officer. He says, that's a KY-3. At the time, it required a TS clearance, a TS or crypto clearance. She had this black night vision device that she carried around in a paper bag. Naval and Air Force NCOs from Belle Chasse Naval Air Stations were bringing her communiques. And it was funny because they'd be in civilian clothes, but they'd have the military shoes on and their military ID card sticking up out of their shirt pocket. I mean, great disguise. And they'd bring these sealed communiques, and then there was this guy named Freddie, who had been a veteran of the 3rd Battalion, 5th Special Forces, who she went out with at night. And I got to meet a whole bunch of people who worked for a company named Brown & Root, major CIA contractor. They built Cameron Bay. They are one of the major homes of sheep-dipped employees. For those of you who don't know what sheep-dipping is, it's when CIA takes a guy out of the agency spy school and puts them in IBM or some company as their cover to go travel around the world. So all these people are shipping out for Iran. Now, by the way, I didn't mention that Teddy grew up with the niece of the Shah of Iran. And she used to get letters all the time from Iran. And Teddy was American. And one time the Shah's nephew, Shahryar, came and picked her up, took her out to dinner. So anyway, I'm watching her make arrangements for all kinds of guns to leave. And then later I'm hearing her make arrangements for certain packages to be dropped off on oil rigs in the Gulf. And they would be stashed on the oil rigs down on the pilings. And bubbleheads, as they call them, deep sea divers, hard hats, would go down and pull up the packages of heroin at the same time that a service boat coming out to bring food would arrive at the oil rig, not subject to customs search. And the divers would just toss the heroin on, and the whole Carlos Marcelo controlled the whole dock operation in New Orleans. So here I saw, and CIA was the name CIA was dropped six or seven times while I was there. I saw scrambled communications and letterheads and all this stuff. So they were controlling an operation where guns were going out and drugs were coming in. This was 1977. So after 8 days, I said, goodbye, I'm leaving, I don't want anything to do with you people. And for those of us who have been through this, it is a very painful loss of innocence. I can't tell you how painful it is to begin to discover that your country is really dirty. And you do it in stages. You don't let go all at once. I came back, I told everybody, leave me alone. And they wouldn't. I kept getting followed, chased. I got shot at once in New Orleans. And I wound up going into a hospital for stress. Basically because OCID said they were going to commit me under one of their psychiatrists. So I said, okay, I'm going into my own hospital. And I got tested 8 ways from Sunday. And they said I was perfectly sane. And I fought a little battle. It was injured on duty. I returned, earned the highest rating reports possible in LAPD. Was about to be promoted. Was on staff at the police academy. And the Iranian Revolution broke loose. And I started to make some more connections. And that's when I started getting death threats and burglarized. I wound up taking a tape-recorded death threat, and I asked to see Chief Darryl Gates. Where do you go if organized crime intelligence is lying to you? In LAPD, there is no place else you go but the chief. And I said, I got a problem, because Darryl Gates had just been made chief, and his bodyguard driver was a guy by the name of John Xavier Vach. And I said, I can't see Darryl while Vach's there, because he's CIA. And I got a message back from Sergeant Pickering, a friend of mine who had relayed the message. Well, the chief realizes that somebody may be trying to kill you. He's kind of busy. He can give you 5 or 10 minutes in a week or 10 days. Would you like to make an appointment? I want to show you something. I'm going to be giving this out at the press conference at the rally that we're doing this weekend. This is from the Los Angeles Times, and the date on this is November 17, 1984. Officers moonlighting probed. If you read this, it talks about a detective who went back to organized crime intelligence named John Xavier Vach. And then it says, copies of official records of the California Department of Justice that contain information about criminal history of members of the Jewish Defense League, according to the government code, turned over a transcript of the conversation between Glowley and Earl to employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, who Rapasky identified as Jack Harmeyer. He was moonlighting for the Central Intelligence Agency on city time, and he was convicted in municipal court. Okay? No corroboration for my story whatsoever, right? Not according to the LA Times. I had alleged in 1978 that he was CIA. Okay? So I wound up resigning. I got an attorney, and I got an attorney who was a former FBI intelligence agent. Don't hold it against me. Look, we have to learn. I was way ahead of you guys on this, you know. This was in 78. I went to the FBI. I wrote to Sam Hayakawa, Bob Dornan, Alan Cranston. Sam Hayakawa was a very gracious and wonderful gentleman. He was the only elected official who ever went to bat for me in all these years. He is the only one who ever did. Anyway, got on the record wherever I could, and I documented everything I had seen in New Orleans. To sum up the points that I made in a 4.5-hour complaint to the FBI that I later made to a reporter, David Rosenzweig, at the LA Times, who until recently was assistant managing editor of the LA Times, to all the congresspeople, to everything else, I said, Carlos Marcello, guns, drugs, CIA, Hawaii, California, Mexico, submarines, Texas, Louisiana, terrorist and rebel groups. That was in 1978. Item from the Los Angeles Times. You're going to love this one. Guns for drugs trade booming, reports disclose. From Newsday. Times didn't write it, but they reprinted the story from Newsday. Okay? And what it says is, Carlos Marcello, guns, drugs, terrorist groups, Baja California, submarines, Texas, Louisiana, the Bahamas, and everything I had said a year before. The LA Times said, there's no story here. No corroboration. David Rosenzweig, after this came out, was promoted from staff writer to assistant city editor. Okay. I called the writer for that story, Tom Renner, and I mentioned the name Bonneau, and he said, wait a minute, LAPD, Bonneau? Turned through his pages. I've got this guy Bonneau's name in connection with a CIA machine gun factory in Mexico. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. So he says, call this investigator, Bill Christensen, who's working for DeConcini's Committee on Improvements in Judicial Machinery. Great name. So I called Christensen up, and I run through all this stuff. Now I know. CIA is dealing drugs. They're protecting Marcello. They're hand in glove. They're partners, and CIA is profiting from the deals. Okay? I call Christensen. I lay it out. He says, you're right. My offices are bugged. I'm getting followed. We were burglarized last week. This is a Senate investigator. This is 1979. Okay? He says, we'll get you back here to testify. That was the first time I was promised I could testify. Short time later, I had to start looking for a job. I was a writer, and I'd been laid off from one writing job, and I couldn't find a job anywhere in this city, and I would see unmarked LAPD cars turning up outside of places where I go for interviews. After about 3 weeks, I took a job at a 7-Eleven store because I needed to eat. My first day on the job, somebody calls up and says, is Mike Rupert working today? My second day on a job, I was arrested for selling liquor to a minor. The second time I was shot at after that, I was dead drunk. I was on my lawn. I mean, I really didn't care much anymore. And somebody shot at me. I didn't even bother to report it at that time. You know, I was just ready to give up. But you can't give up. That's what I found out. I wish I had a choice. I really do wish I had a choice. So I kept pursuing and pursuing and pursuing. And eventually, one reporter from the days when we had a paper in this town Randall Sullivan, I made the front page of the Herald Examiner two Sundays in a row, October 11th and October 18th, 1981. There's a full page. I love this part. It says, Mike Rupert, perhaps LAPD's most intelligent officer. I really like that one. If I'm so intelligent, what am I doing this for? Okay, it lays out all the stuff about CIA, and it actually even finally mentioned down here, after the end of two parts in 2 weeks, CIA dealing drugs. So I am on the record in October of 1981. I even have documents back from the FBI saying that I said it back in 1980. So I do have a claim to some seniority here. What that gets me, I have no idea. Now, by this time, Ronald Reagan is president. Craig Fuller is assistant to President Reagan for Cabinet Affairs. Craig Fuller's name turns up in this article.
Whose voice I hear. the sleepers, soften the dead, arise my body, and gentle carry my troubles.